Conversations with Q. I'm Lucia, Q's Marketing Director, and every week I have a chat with a marketer or entrepreneur from the tech space to get to the bottom of a bunch of things that are probably fascinating you, inspiring you, or downright puzzling you right now. Think how to make decisions about your career, what it actually takes to build a successful startup, marketing tactics you should and shouldn't bother with, the dark side of hustle culture, equality in the tech industry, and more. I'm really excited to share the penultimate episode of Conversations with Q Season 2 with you, because I had a fascinating chat with our guest, Dan Murray-Serta. Dan is a London-based entrepreneur who so far in his career has founded a string of really cool companies, from a QR code advertising platform that targeted student drinking games to the multi-award winning fashion app, Grabble. His most recent venture is Dawn, which serves up bite-sized portions of the latest in neuroscience, nutrition and psychology for its subscribers every Sunday morning. Dan also hosts the highly successful podcast Secret Leaders, whose guests include everyone from Starling Bank founder Anne Boden to celebrity photographer Rankin. Dan was kind enough to tell me how he had achieved these whirlwind successes, but equally the failures he encountered along the way. A recurring theme among even the most successful entrepreneurs, as I'm starting to notice. So one question I always really love to ask guests at the beginning of each episode is, as a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Obviously an astronaut, no, I'm joking. I just feel like that's what everyone says. So when I was a kid, I for some reason wanted to be a screenwriter. And it's a bit of an unusual one, it's a bit niche, but ultimately I was fascinated by the way that people told stories. Yeah. And I loved films, and I would always watch films, but instead of just enjoying them for what they were, I would always be so curious about what was going on beneath it to get the story out. And so that was just something that I was always really curious about. Now, sadly, I haven't grown up and done that, but when I graduated from university, that is the first job that I technically had, was working in a screenwriting studio.
Oh, really? That's cool. Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, because you did do English and art history at university, so I guess that's kind of related to the storytelling.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I also actually studied English at university, so I'm kind of interested to ask you, do you think your degree and university experience kind of shaped you in a way that set you up for the career path you have now?
Definitely not. For me, personally, if I look back at university, I think either it was all a big waste of my time, or I, knowing what I know now, I would have just chosen completely different courses. So the reality is I took what was easiest for me so I could have fun. And I did. I had a great time at uni. But was it as meaningful an opportunity to learn and build my career as it could have been? No. And that obviously comes down to the choices I made at the time to have an easier ride. But, you know, looking back on it, I wish I'd have studied either philosophy or psychology, because I think that those two disciplines are arguably two of the most transferable and meaningful in most professional jobs, whereas the outcome of me taking English was pretty much that I never wanted to read fiction ever again.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely know the feeling. I think I had several years after uni where I just kind of stopped reading, which was bizarre.
Exactly.
Because I'd always
been... I did as well. I had several years. I only just, you know, I've gotten back into reading so much, but it's really all business and philosophy and, you know, different perspectives, but it's very little fiction now, because I've just gone right off it from having it shoved down my throat so much.
Yeah, I know, I'm exactly the same. And I think, I mean, there are some transferable skills I think I got from my degree, but now I look back, it just seems quite sort of self-indulgent, and I really enjoyed the course, had a great time, but yeah, probably didn't.
What if they are so transferable? Could you transfer some of them to me then, please?
I'll let you know. So you mentioned then that your first job out of uni was doing screenwriting. So could you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah, I was very lucky, but I very lucky and unlucky, but I got to work in Anthony Minghella's film studio.
Oh, cool.
And he was the director of The English Patient and Talented Mr. Ripley and Cold Mountain, so he was one of the UK's greatest assets in terms of filmmaking. And it was amazing because I would read scripts and I would learn and I would essentially pass things up essentially scripts would come in and you had to essentially read everything and then you had to understand what kinds of things his production studio was looking to produce that year and if it fell within that remit or whatever, it would pass on to someone else. So obviously I was, you know, very junior in the sense that I was the first port there, and you were able to then work with some of the, you know, on stuff that went through the next station. You were able to then sort of discuss with them what edits and what ideas might happen. So I got sort of the inside track of what happens from screenwriting to producing, really. And it was really fascinating. But sadly, whilst I was working there, he passed away.
Oh, okay.
Quite suddenly, it all happened very quickly. And it wasn't really well set up to deal with, you know, the head honcho of that company passing away, and basically I just needed to find a new job because it just wasn't clear what was going to happen. The whole thing just went into freefall, so it was really sad because he was amazing, a really great guy.
Yeah, well, what a start to your kind of entry into the real world after university, I guess. But so then you moved into I think advertising at a publishing company, and it looks like you kind of did several sales and marketing roles in the years following that. So was that really just kind of a bit of an accident that you fell into that, or did you have a clear idea following the screenwriting that that was what you wanted to do?
No, I wanted to use my creative interests and mediocre talents to apply somewhere relevantly. And in my mind, it seemed to be really sensible that advertising might be a really good place for that.
Yeah.
So I always believed as well that if you learn sales, then you can do most things because you always need sales in almost everything that you do. So I followed that path of, essentially, I actually went to go work in a pub in Hampstead after Anthony passed away because there were no jobs because it was 2007 and it was a recession.
Yeah.
So I went to work there for actually a year and I ended up talking to a punter so much that he ended up offering me a job in his agency, and that's how I got my first advertising job. But from that point on, most of my roles were based around sales or creative advertising, which is in another way essentially sales, because we're coming up with a way to mass sell things to consumers. And I think it was a really important skill to learn. It certainly made me happy for quite a few years. I found it a really interesting experience and quite an interesting industry.
Yeah, I'm sure. And you set up your first business, Deal 52, in 2013. So did you kind of have that bug, like you wanted to start working for yourself?
No, is the honest truth. So my business partner, Joel, who is still my business partner, had that desperate bug. He was at PwC and really unhappy. In my situation was really different. Like, I was finally in a company that I thought treated me really well, respected me professionally, and was giving me the creative freedom to thrive. So I had a great insight as an employee, as someone who is extremely driven and extremely, focused on what a good career path looks like. And they managed to make me feel, without having to use money especially, I certainly wasn't the best paid person that I knew by any means, but they'd given me all of the things that I really needed to thrive in my role and therefore deliver value to the company. And that made me feel really valued. And so there wasn't this niggling desperation to go and prove myself or do anything different. Whereas Joel was at PwC. Mm. So, you know, that is the complete and utter different experience, where he was paid far better than I was. But, you know, he was in an environment which didn't celebrate individualism or creativity or anything, and he was desperate to leave. And because he knew that we've got very different skills, was actually him nagging me to leave, which was a much harder sell because I had nothing wrong at the time.
Yeah, must have been quite a big risk for you to take.
It felt way more risky for me than for him. And again, yeah. It's ironic because he earned a lot more money than I did.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, it just felt really like tough. Yeah, it's a really difficult decision to leave your company and go off into the unknown. And you get really attached to the safety net of your salary, of course.
Yeah.
So it's hard to consider actually leaving, but we did it anyway. I'm delighted that we did, but it was, yeah, stressful.
Yeah, so what actually spurred you to leave? Was it just that you believed in the idea? And it would be great if you could tell us a little bit more about what Deal 52 was.
Mm. So Deal 52 was, based on a very simple fact that I'd been working in student and youth advertising, and the QR codes were becoming popular at the time, if you can imagine that. And the reality is a bunch of advertisers that I would work with were always looking for creative ways to get in front of students. And one of the things that I'd actually recognized was most students that we would do campaigns with, etc., you know, they all played drinking games. And so whenever they would go to drink together, they played drinking games with cards, and I came up with this idea with Joel that, you know, what if we could get our cards into all the different Wetherspoons in the country, and using QR codes we could essentially update the deal every single week. And it was just, you know, Deal 52 is not a very inventive name, but there's 52 cards in a pack, obviously, and yeah, there's 52 days a week, 52 days weeks in a year, sorry, I got there eventually.
Sometimes it feels like there are 50
days. The idea was we would just change the drinks offer every single week, which would give people a good reason to come back and play drinking games in Wetherspoons pubs as opposed to at home on their own. And one week you'd get a Jack and Coke for £1, and the next week you'd get, a Bacardi and a Bacardi Coke for £1, whatever it might be. And all you had to do was scan the same pack of cards and see what the drink was that week, and the client would change it in the back end. So it was kind of bringing offline and online together.
Yeah.
Now, the reality is obviously no one bothered to scan the cards or anything, so it was not as exciting as we had first thought, but it was a really good first go of something, and it was really interesting just to be in control of the end-to-end process.
Sure. So then what did you do after that business?
So we decided that we didn't like that business for a number of reasons. Number one reason was just really hard to scale and not very exciting.
Yeah.
There's a lot of admin, a lot of physical products that you have to move all the time, and very little evidence that customers were really that into it. So we decided to just stop, and we started a new company, which essentially was a daily deal business. So if you remember, in that particular period, Groupon had just been offered $5 billion to be bought by Google. Everyone was on a Groupon or a Living Social or whatever. And we had this insight, again, using the student market as an example. We're like, but no one's targeting that market specifically, yet they're the most deal-hungry people. Surely any idiot can run a daily deal site at the moment and make a good go of it. And that was the kind of really bolshy, borderline, arrogant, well, not really borderline, factually arrogant perspective. and we found a whole bunch of third-party software providers, so we didn't have to build any tech or employ anyone. And we just got to work creating this daily deal platform that was targeting students. And we set it all up and launched it within about 3 months. The day that we launched it, it basically went viral because we did this deal with Hungry House, the takeaway delivery company.
Oh, yeah.
And our launch deal was if you took a, if you signed up for us, sorry, I'm just trying to remember it, it was a while ago. If you signed up to us, you got a free £5 takeaway from Hungry House, and every single time someone redeemed it, we got paid £1.50 in commission.
Mm.
But in the first day it got onto UK Hot Deals or something, and then a whole bunch of student platforms, and that was kind of it. It went viral and we got very excited, thinking that we were going to become millionaires, obviously. Yeah. We're very only fools and horses. The reality is, you know, we had that amazing launch deal, and then we really struggled to find deals after that people were engaged with. So that company did not last long, but it was a super interesting and exciting ride to start something online and go viral really quickly. You know, it gave us our first taste of what could be.
Yeah, it's always a really good learning experience, even if you fail, I think, with startups. But it seems like you're quite good at kind of tapping into cultural trends and like forming business ideas around those. So I'd love to hear a bit more about your current business venture, Dawn, which dishes up bite-sized portions of the latest in neuroscience, nutrition, and psychology for its users every Sunday morning. So how did that idea for Dawn come about, and what have you got planned for the future?
Yeah, slightly different, huh?
Yeah.
So,
more of a noble cause, I guess.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So the reality is, after we did the Daily Deal business, we started a company called Grabble. And that was a really fantastic ride. So we decided we were going to raise money and, you know, scale fast and build essentially a shopping app. So it was a mobile shopping app experience. It had all the classic markings of a typical startup ride. So, you know, very fast growth. We raised £4 million. We had over 1 million users every single month on our app. We became the number one shopping app in the UK for a good few months. Sometimes battling it out was our ASOS right at the top. So
it was
a very exciting period. But ultimately, the company there became a whole bottomless pit of cash, sadly. So whilst it made lots of revenue, it was impossible to scale the profit margins. And we had a real, like, real problem with it. And essentially, because we don't have too long, but the long story short there is the company ended up imploding. The reality of the journey for myself and Joel is, you know, it was a hugely stressful ride, but one of the things that we became really good at as the leaders having to scale, I guess, ourselves during this period was what we could do for our own mental state to handle the ups and downs, to come into work motivated and energetic and able to deal with those sharp turns of events all the time. During that period, that's where we basically became fascinated in, well, essentially, I'd always been reading stuff about neuroscience, but we were both really interested in mindset, you know, all the different practices from meditation to breath work to, you know, anything slightly borderline. I'm far more on the spiritual woo-woo side, I would say, than Joel, who's very scientific based and hates that kind of stuff if it's not scientific, which gives us a good mix when we're talking about things. And then I'd actually gone on a bit of an unusual journey during my time with Grabble. I basically decided one day I was going to be vegan. As you do.
Oh, I've done that as well.
Part of learning how to have the optimal health, exactly.
Yeah.
So I went from being carnivore, like full-on carnivore, to vegan overnight. It was all good. Obviously, it was all very hard, but because I'm into things like mindset and it's all in the mind, it was just a case of just making decisions every time I was putting something in my mouth. So I was like, it's a good challenge. Anyway, after 9 months, body felt really good, but the reality is my brain was actually suffering, and I was suffering from some short-term memory concerns, which felt a bit unusual. And I was telling a friend, and they told me to get this book called Optimum Nutrition for the Mind. And it was the first time anyone had really ever mentioned to me that you can eat for your brain, so to speak, because then there were certain foods that were good for your brain. And, you know, I'd always heard of nutrition for the body, you know, for fitness, for losing weight, putting on weight, whatever you want, but certainly not for mindset and thinking and focus and all those things. Anyway, I learned that it was a relatively common side effect. It doesn't happen to everyone, but it can happen. But if you go onto a completely plant-based diet after you've been, you know, eating everything all your life, this has happened to a few people before, including the author of that book. And so since reading that book, now my diet is still plant-based, but now with fish and eggs. So it's a slightly different and upgraded, but I certainly learned the value of what foods were considered brain foods and what supplements to be taking and what my essentially nutritional makeup should be alongside everything else to optimize my brain power. And I just became completely engrossed in this concept and found that realistically there's a lot of very boring stuff out there that's not very approachable or particularly interesting. There's a lot of, as I said earlier, and using those words, hate them, but you know, there's a lot of woo-woo, as in pseudoscience. There's not a lot that's like actually science and then turned into something that people will actually consume and read and engage with and essentially find interesting. So using the founding principle of how we work with Grabble, which was essentially we were turning shopping products into, like, sorry, e-commerce products into bite-sized content-driven, I guess, short-form mobile pieces that people could scroll through and want to buy from. The one thing that we've been good at, and I guess you're going to say now that this is where my English degree's come in handy.
We'll see.
Yeah, sadly, it's true. But the one thing that we're good at is communicating and trying to turn boring stuff into engaging and succinct information.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where Dawn started, is we realized that two things. One, it would be great to turn this information that we read in science journals into something that's engaging. And so we write a newsletter that we share every Sunday of brain food. And essentially we write one thing from neuroscience, psychology, or nutrition for the brain that literally comes from the science journals, but we turn it into nice and fun English. So it's three actionable things you can do every week, one from each field. And we like to make it, well, I say actionable, obviously not everything from neuroscience is ultimately actionable, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
And we always make sure that it's positive. And our aim is to essentially let people understand their own brain. We believe that if people understand how their brain works, then hopefully they can avoid things like mental health concerns simply by understanding inputs and outputs. And after all, you know, information is power, as they say. Whether or not people choose to use the information is a whole different thing, but making sure that people have access to it and making sure that it's more consumable on a wider spread perspective than just nerds and science people is, to me, really important. If I consider myself as a customer, someone who massively interested in all this stuff and have never personally come into contact with the idea of nutrition for the brain, I think that gives me a really good understanding of just how far there is in terms of space to go to educate people.
Sure, and it's such a great idea because it's so overwhelming. There is so much knowledge and information out there, but kind of picking out the actually useful things, you know, is really
difficult. Yeah, it's hard, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot.
Yeah, what are some, you've kind of talked about nutrition, but what are some other habits that you've cultivated to look after your brain health and kind of make sure that you're functioning well as an entrepreneur and business owner?
That is a great question. Great habits. Let's see, do I have any great habits? Well, I use a standing desk at work, which I think is really important.
Yeah.
So really interestingly, but if you were to exercise 3 or 4 times a week, doing, you know, some pretty intense, like very good, like gym exercise work, let's say high intensity training, whatever, and you do that for your whole life, there is quite a lot of science behind the fact that even that is not as good for your longevity, so your lifespan, as being active and moving at shorter regular intervals, which is kind of crazy to me.
Yeah.
So it's a really fascinating thing, but we put so much pressure on ourselves to go to the gym, to really push. And by the way, those things are really good, like doing resistance weights is especially good for us. But you know, a much simpler approach to being healthy in life is actually just getting up off your seat. So if you are in an office-based job, which, you know, I certainly am, making sure I'm on my feet and moving is one of the most important things I can do for my health. So That is one habit that I recommend and do, and it takes a lot of getting used to, and you get tired at about 3 o'clock, but it's good.
Okay.
I also do the highly cringy trend at the moment, but I've been doing it for a long time, intermittent fasting.
Okay. So I can't imagine doing it because I just worry that I'd pass out from hunger.
Well, it's funny. Like, I'll tell you, because I have an app that tracks how many hours I've been doing it. So I'll tell you what I'm on today so far. So currently today I've been fasting for 18 hours and 18 minutes since I last ate.
Wow. But I imagine you just get used to it after a while. You
know, I'm not even hungry right now, genuinely.
That's incredible.
And it's kind of good. Like, you get to really enjoy your food when you eat. You can pig out and really not feel bad. It's quite an interesting thing. Not saying that you should, but... So, for example, today I'm going to go for 20 hours. That's just a habit. But the reason I do that is mostly for mental clarity. So... there's a bunch of evidence as to why that's good for your body, but to be honest with you, like, the things that I'm particularly interested in is mental focus.
Okay.
It does help focus your mind, and it's also just really not very distracting if you're not having to think about what you're going to eat the whole time. So that's another habit that's a bit unusual. Now, something nice that I do with my wife before I go to sleep, we write three things every night before we go to sleep, three things that went well today.
Okay.
Which is particularly good if you've had a shit day.
Yes, I can imagine. So sometimes,
bad day, then thinking about a nicer way to think about it is a really important thing to do.
Yeah, just even the small things sometimes can make so much difference.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just really nice. So it's just little things like that. I mean, I could go on, but I don't want to sound like a freak. So.
No, I think those are some really good actionable habits, and I'm absolutely terrified by what you said about the exercise you do and how it's better just to move in the day. So maybe I'll start going.
Right?
But yeah, it's fascinating, especially when you think of like all the money and stuff people spend on going to the gym and the time and everything. But yeah, I keep getting a lot of those emails at the moment, or sort of seeing Medium posts that are all saying sitting down is killing us, and it's definitely something to think about.
It's really interesting and it's really odd, but yes, I mean, I think I've seen probably a very similar one to you, which is you know, sitting down all your life is equivalent of smoking like 20 cigarettes a day or something.
Terrifying.
So it's such a mental way to think about comparing something, but you know, it's just the way that your body works as well. So it's like it's also just a metabolism thing. It's just good to be moving. I think as long as you're moving every hour, that's great. Like, the extreme version at the other end of the spectrum is obviously what I do, which is standing up all day. But at the same time, when I started doing it, my main thinking around it was, I used to be a bartender. This isn't that hard. This is what literally what that job
is. Yeah. And we've all done that probably at some point in our lives, done a bartending waitress
thing. There's just so many good examples of jobs that we've all done, where you are on your feet all day. It's just as soon as you're in front of the screen, you're like, that's weird.
Yeah, it's really strange, actually. So another one of your projects I'd love to talk to you about is your podcast, which is really successful, and it's called Secret Leaders. And you interview CEOs and founders behind some of the world's leading brands, so Calm, Jo Malone, Uber, Deliveroo, and so many more. So what inspired you to start this podcast?
So I was really lucky in that I was, in my last company, Gravel, I got to meet so many interesting people because we were scaling so fast. You know, I would go to other inspiring leaders that I thought had all the answers, and I would ask them, you know, what should I do about this problem I've got and that problem I've got? They were always really generous in answering and telling me. Now, the reality is, I, after a while, felt bad that I'd met so many interesting people, and it turns out they're all really quite willing to be vulnerable and helpful. I felt a bit selfish just holding the information onto myself. So, you know, I went to a couple of them, you know, who I'd found incredibly inspiring, and just asked, you know, would they be open to being recorded for a podcast? And this was, you know, almost 3 years ago. So whilst podcasting had already been around for ages, it wasn't quite as mental as it currently is in terms of, you know, there's such an amazing interest in podcasting at the moment. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wasn't quite as noisy as it is at the moment, which was awesome because it meant that I was able to go and record these guests. And Rich and I, so Rich is a friend of mine who also runs a technology company, and he was more interested in the production side, so learning how to put one out there rather than what I was interested in, which was being nosy and asking awkward questions.
Yeah, me too.
So it was quite a good mix because neither of us actually liked what each other actually did or had any interest in trying to do that. So it was a good partnership there. And we got lucky because we basically just recorded the series really ad hoc and really average. We spent £250 producing the whole series. And we just put it out week by week. And, you know, we were recording things the night before it would go out. Recording the intro and outro because we'd forgotten to do it, things like that. But after the first series, we got 25,000 downloads. So we were like,
that's amazing.
No marketing.
Yeah.
And we're like, that's really quite impressive, we think. I mean, we don't know, but we're like, it sounds like a good number. And it certainly sounds like good enough to do a second one and try and make a bit more effort. So once we had some numbers behind us that we could use to validate, we actually took in some sponsorship and decided to go inside a studio and record them properly. And, you know, it's in itself is a perfect startup journey because anyone that runs a startup, in theory, should know the process, which is you're doing little tests to validate if the market wants your product, and if not, you should change before spending all your money. And so that's essentially what we've been doing with Secret Leaders. You know, it's a little bit by little bit each series, just improving and making sure that the market actually wants what we're putting out before we go all crazy on you know, doing something that sounds amazing but technically isn't actually what people like. And so we've been pretty good at taking feedback from people and understanding what kind of guests they want to hear and what kind of questions as well.
I think that's I read a post you wrote on your kind of the things you'd learn about starting a podcast, and I sort of related to it a lot because when you start out you don't really have any idea what you're doing, and then you with practice you get better at it, hopefully. But yeah, I think that listening to feedback thing is actually really vital, and I've had some other guests on this show say the same thing, and it's really just about the content that you're putting out, and if you get that right, everything else will follow and you don't really even need to do as much marketing.
Yeah, I think it's completely true. I mean, basically the real, like what we've learned is the only way that we grow really is through recommendations.
Yeah.
So people tell people, that's pretty much it. I mean, it's not the world's most exciting or sophisticated plan.
Yeah.
But that's literally just what happens is people tell their friends to listen to this particular episode. I mean, literally, as you were talking to me, one of our previous guests, Mills, who is the founder of Us2, which is an amazing agency. They made Monument Valley, which is one of the most successful games ever.
Oh, cool.
He's literally just Instagrammed a photo of him listening to the Starling Bank episode. So, you know, this is such a great episode, blah, 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 everyone should listen.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really good example of, you know, Mills is someone that, as a guest, I'd never met before. Since becoming a guest, like him and I talk all the time, and he loves the podcast, so he listens to loads of the other guests as well and then shares their episodes. So, you know, you can get that happening, and that's just a really natural way to grow. But that only happens if you listen to feedback.
Yeah. What do you think makes a great interviewer, and what do you think makes a great guest?
Well, if I'm honest, a great interviewer is someone who comes prepared with, I mean, it depends on the type of podcast, incidentally, but comes prepared with information and research about that guest, just like you've done, is a really good example, because it's funny for me being answering questions. It's very
rare for me, that, but
I'm noticing
the other side.
Emotionally, every time you drop in a nugget like you've researched, it makes me feel really comfortable to talk to you.
Good.
So it's a really interesting insight for me because I always do my research on the guests, and you know, they're always quite surprised, and they often comment on the fact that other people don't do that. So
really,
so obvious, but a lot of people just wing it. And it's like, if you're going to take someone else's time, if you demonstrate that you've done your research or tried to make some effort and finding out about them before the interview, it's going to make it go better.
Yeah.
So that is the hallmark of a good host, as is shutting up and listening. So my biggest learning after series one was I talked way too much. I interrupted guests. I tried to be funny, all this crap. And the interviews just did not flow anywhere near as well as they have done since, because I've learned to ask a question and just stay quiet, which, again, something that you're good at, I've noticed. So it's a hard skill, though.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and I think it's sometimes also difficult when you're not actually in person and you're talking, you know, like we're talking over a call right now, so you don't have those visual cues as well.
No, totally. I mean, and I can't relate to that on the basis of I've actually never done, like, all of my interviews are in person.
Yeah, if you can do it, I think that's a really good thing to do. I mean, a lot of guests on this show are based in America, so...
No, of course, I could get that. And this is the thing, you know, and when I was in America for a month, so I went to interview a bunch of them face-to-face. But for Secret Leaders, we just had an agreement between Rich and I is that we'd only interview people if we could do it face-to-face. And that is a totally limiting factor, and I don't think it's that important, but I do think it can help you build rapport. And realistically, if I think about some of the guests that I've genuinely become, I would say, friends, that comes from meeting them face to face and just getting on and sharing values, which is way harder to do on a phone call.
Sure. Yeah.
So there is some really good benefit of it as well.
Definitely. And so what do you think makes a good guest?
Well, you tell me. I think it's someone who is able to be vulnerable, talkative, and reflect honestly on things that have gone badly as well as well. I think it's really boring listening to a guest that everything's gone well for. It's just, you don't learn anything.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
No, I agree. I think people, especially nowadays, there is a big interest in failure and what we can learn from that.
Well, it's just that all you know, realistically, people grow from experiences of overcoming challenges.
Yeah.
And so it's really, like, in my opinion, it's just such an obvious it's such an obvious thing to do, to be open about what went wrong so other people get to learn and avoid those mistakes. I mean, that's a huge part of any personal growth I've had has come from my guests sharing things that went wrong that they'd have done differently, and that's given me an opportunity to think about things differently and take a different approach. And if you think that everyone around you is just doing everything perfectly all the time, it really doesn't help.
Yeah, and that actually brings me on to my next question, which is about your TED Talk, which I really enjoyed, by the way.
Thank you.
Does Laughter Build Resilience? And for our listeners who haven't watched that, I'll link to it in the show notes because you definitely should watch it. But it's a really moving tribute to your father, who, despite numerous illnesses and obstacles, always managed to see the funny side of life. And the message is that we should all use laughter at the right times to combat stress. So, relating to this, I'd really like to know what you make of the current kind of fetishization of stress in the startup world. And this is something we've discussed numerous times on the podcast, that kind of toxic hustle culture bred by the bropreneurs of LinkedIn. And they, you know, feed the idea that giving up sleep is the route to success and something to aspire to. And, you know, you just touched on the fact that we're always seeing these perfect versions of people on Instagram, which I think can be quite damaging. So having, you know, been an entrepreneur for a number of years and worked in the startup world, have you kind of witnessed this culture or, like, fallen victim to it yourself even?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it is such bollocks, but the thing is, like, if I'm being completely honest, I think it's such bollocks, but it's obvious that it's obvious that it works for some, right? As in, let's not pretend that Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Richard Branson, yada, 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 let's not pretend that they didn't get there from hustling and working every single minute of every single day. Like, they're incredible. However, I just don't think that that is the most important thing in the world. And I also just think that a far more interesting metric for a company's success is whether or not you're happy and your employees are happy. We do, in our company, we talk a lot about founder sustainability and company sustainability. And this is sustainability in our own ability to accept that we're running a marathon, not a sprint. Burnout is extremely real, and we kind of suffered that off our last company by buying into the hustle culture. And then the reality is we work really hard. Like I work most weekends, but at the same time, we are building a company around human potential. Yeah. And that's the way that we frame everything. And so the reality to us is, we're like, what time do you want to, what is the perfect day to you? And what time do you want to come in? So, you know, we've got interns that came in today at 10:30 on a Monday, but like, we don't care, as in they have been clearly explained to what our goals are for the month in an outcome basis, working with them on how they optimize their time to achieve their goals or where their blockers are is far more interesting to us than whether they come in at 9 or not.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for us. So, like I say, I work a lot on weekends, but that's also because I feel like I've got a more free time on a weekend. What I don't do anymore, which I used to, is get up at like 6 a.m. and start working by 7 a.m. Now I have a completely different lifestyle where I get up and I make sure, you know, I go to the gym and I come back and I make breakfast and I spend a bit of time with my wife and we just have a nice relaxing start to the morning. You know, I start later and I finish later because I'd rather have a nicer morning. But, you know, and my business partner has a different kind of routine. Mm. And the reality is, you know, we're looking at how we can scale out an outcome-focused organization that takes into account what happiness looks like inside of an organization, which is you're paid professionally to achieve an outcome, and those outcomes are still team-related, so you still have to figure out how we get there as a team. But one person's definition of achieving that is waking up at the crack of dawn and, you know, just going for it, and another person's is absolutely not, and we shouldn't be there dictating these things. So yeah. I think the hustle culture stuff is hugely misaligned, and I think it will definitely breed a whole generation of incredibly purposeless and disappointed employees who suffer from acute anxiety.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's what people have to understand is that everyone's different. And I love that management style that you just talked about. And I really hope that that's something we see more in companies. And I think it's certainly happening. A lot of startup founders I've spoken to have a similar approach. So kind of leading on from that, I'd love to talk to you a bit about the tech industry in general and, well, just the world of business. I know that later this week, you're hosting an event on female leadership and equality for International Women's Day. So to get us to a place of true equality and inclusion in business and the tech industry, what do you think needs to change?
I think it's a really interesting question. So the obvious answer is education. So is making sure at a younger age, more women are encouraged to join STEM or STEAM, as it's now known. So science, technology, engineering, and maths. The reality is, like looking into the data as I have been this week, it is fascinating. So typically speaking, of every pound that goes into venture capital, only one pence goes into an all-female founding team. And that sounds really disgusting, but then, like, when you look into it even further, and I've had this debate with tons of female founders in my network, so, because what I want to do is come from an informed position, not simply a man's point of view where you're looking for all the negative and then trying to just get female founders talking about the negatives. It turns out there's a lot more to it. So if you actually delve into it, whilst that sounds terrible, the fact of the matter is the majority of venture capital funding goes into software businesses, and software businesses are way less likely to be founded by all female teams anyway. And that's also accounting for the fact that the software industry only has 26% of it represented as women. So if only 26% of the software industry are women, then it stands to reason that way less of them are going to be female founders. So it's really interesting when you go down that path. And then if you go even further, it looks like most female founded businesses don't actually look to take funding. So they tend to have a much smaller risk profile. They take loans, but they don't take venture capital funding. They actually tend to run businesses much more sensibly than men, broadly speaking. Again, I don't want to make any broad claims like that too badly, or insult my own gender, but it certainly seems to be true. So they look to create businesses that, you know, realistically do what they're meant to do, which is provide value to the customer with a profit margin so that they can run. And most of those businesses are not, they're not required to have venture capital funding at any point. So I think it's a really interesting one when it comes to the tech industry, because I think the top line numbers are skew-iff, as in they're terrible. Yeah. And if I tell you that a penny in every pound goes to an all-female founding team, that sounds horrific.
Mm.
But then if you actually go in a wider context of how many businesses in the UK are run by women versus men, I think the numbers are 1/3 to 2/3, which is still not 50-50, of course, and more can be done, but it's a lot better than the 1% that I was just discussing.
Yeah.
So I do think this stuff has a lot of nuance with industry specific and where we are today as a society. And that leads me back to the same point, which is, you know, I was in House of Commons last year, actually campaigning for more women, about 18 months ago, for more women to be encouraged at school to take technology and science subjects, because that's really where the problem comes from. If you're running a technology company, you're not allowed to do anything like positive discrimination, of course, but if you put out a job post for a developer, you will get, you know, maybe 100 applications and one will be a woman and 99 will be men. So it's really clear, just as the founder looking to employ people, that there simply is not the volume of people working in the industry as there is with men. So that's a really, to me, just becomes the most obvious place to start in education.
Yeah, completely agree, yeah. I mean, it's a huge subject, but I think it's great that we're having so many more conversations about it and people are educating themselves. And, you know, there's so much that can be done in schools and with the younger generation.
Mm.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, so many of these topics I could talk to you for a lot longer on, but I know you've got other very important things to do with your day. So finally, where can our listeners follow you and your work?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked. So my, I guess, online presence is at Dan Murray Serta, which hopefully you can put in the show notes. That's just on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, you name it. There was the benefit of taking my wife's surname after mine, as it's now unique enough that I can use the same thing on everything. Of course, Secret Leaders, which is available on iTunes and Spotify, or secretleaders.com. And I guess most importantly, for anyone where Dawn sounded interesting, then check it out. You can read some of the past newsletters on trydawn.co.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Conversations with Q. We'll be back next week with another very special guest, and in the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback. So please do rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.